Well, was that it then? We've waited 2, maybe 3 years for Gordon Brown's big pronouncements on constitutional change, and it seems that in many ways the offering has gone back on what Labour actually promised in their 2019 manifesto. No unlimited borrowing powers for Scotland, no entrenched nature to our Scottish Parliament, just the bulwark of a newly reconstituted second chamber that doesn't change parliamentary sovereignty one iota. Westminster is still in charge. We look at all the arguments for and against those proposals. We look also at the suggestion that Labour, if they had their heads screwed on, would have an immediate independence referendum should they win, because it would be more likely to go the union's way under a benign Labour government than a nasty Tory one. We look also at the impending change at the top of the Westminster SNP leadership. Those are the headlines. Now for the podcast.
Hi, Choms, and welcome to this week's Leslie Riddick podcast. And it's a Baltic day here, and I hope you're all keeping cozy where you are. But it seems to be back to the future here, Leslie, because we've got to begin with Labour back on the constitutional front. And we've been waiting, I think it's nearly 3 years, for this massive Gordon Brown report to come out. And it has done. And I'm going to let you kick in first here, but I'm very, very underwhelmed by the whole thing.
Everyone's underwhelmed by it, you know, and there's just such an extraordinary level of emperor's clothes around Brune, you know, in that somebody who's been a former prime minister just gets treated with kid gloves. And I've watched, you know, I've read some of it. You've read a lot of it. Well done,
yeah.
Pat. So watched lots of interviews about it, which in many ways is as telling, because, you know, how any of the proposals actually get handled, rated, what's given priority by them, by broadcasters, all of it tells you, shuffling the pack, where any of the proposals around Scotland are likely to land. And my God, they are so underwhelming. I mean, Sarah Boyack was on The Nine last night, and Gary Robertson did an excellent interview with her, just sticking to his guns and just asking a couple of things, one of which was, is rejoining Erasmus your big woohoo thing? Now, I'm not downplaying that Erasmus, losing that, having been in quite a number of academic settings recently, it is much mourned. I'm not quite clear how you managed to do that without renegotiating aspects of the Brexit thing, but whatever, you know, okay, so that's one thing. But radical, the idea that also that what Gary really pushed on was that in 2019, Labour had promised unlimited borrowing powers for the Scottish Parliament. Right, that's not in. He had looked at what was promised in the 2019 manifesto, and now looking at what is the woo-woo stuff from Gordon Brown, it's not as adventurous as the 2019 manifesto. So it actually walks back from where things were in 2019, which gives you, again, a good idea of where things are in terms of being promised and then actually any likelihood of them being delivered. So, you know, and then the idea that the actual second chamber, this new second chamber that's got out with the old fogies and in with, well, you know, other fogies, but, you know, regional and national parliament represented fogies, who will somehow, this second chamber will be the thing that stops overreach by Westminster into devolved governments and their business. Well, that's an interesting one, because, again, that doesn't do anything to touch the big problem in Britain, which is the absolute sovereignty of Westminster.
Yep.
So that everything is just there on the say-so of Westminster and can disappear overnight given a change of mind. So what he's doing there, even if it happens, and you'd have to factor in the number of times that Labour have been here before, but, you know, even if they actually go ahead, and even if it happens in the first term, which Keir Starmer is obviously equivocating about, and, you know, first term, as if we're expecting them to automatically get two terms. But anyway, la-di-da, even if all of that happens, the best you get is that Gordon Brown's big reveal, big woof idea, is that there is a sort of movable bulwark put in which can just as easily be overridden, because parliamentary sovereignty will win the day and the structures will not change, because none of this is transformational. It's fiddling at the corners of everything. and trying to liven up yet again a forlorn kind of area in English politics, which is the big problem, which John Prescott's proposals in 2004 didn't manage to do. So here we are, almost 20 years later, with, so they get power over transport, power over this and that. I mean, it's so far from what, if you begin to look at what genuinely powerful local government is across the Nordics, but across most of Northern Europe, an automatic part of your income tax goes to local government. There is no pause on it from anybody else. And that's how local government operates really powerfully. This is so, bloody God, it made me so angry. It's so...
Well, I mean, it was just the, and I noticed this was picked up by, I think it was Mike at Bella Caledonia. I think he picked up on it as well, because when I opened the document up, it virtually, I mean, I had to go to page 100, by the way, at the page 155 pages to actually get to Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. And it came up with Scotland's Parliament and Wales Senate are among the most powerful devolved institutions in the world, comparable to or more powerful than many states or provinces in federal countries. I'm crossing the ball to you, Ms. Riddick. You can head it in as you wish.
Yeah, I mean, this is just bullshit. Utter bullshit. And I mean, they know this or they just don't bother to look around themselves particularly. But if you were to look at Denmark, which is a country not a million miles away from us, even in England, you might sort of style that potentially as a neighbour. The principle of devolution in Denmark is that when one of its dependent territories is ready to take on another power from Copenhagen, it does it. It draws it down. There's not an argument at the centre about whether they can have it or not. They just work essentially along the lines towards pretty much independence as quickly or as slowly as they like. And, of course, to keep reminding people, tiny little pharaohs was able, I mean, when when there was some mention of, you know, that there would be the possibility that Scotland could have, what was it, different international arrangements or something. I was thinking, wow, okay, so we're gonna map the Faroes and let Scotland be in the European Union, like Northern Ireland, whilst England essentially is out. That would be an interesting international arrangement, and it's got a precedent because that's what happens in the Faroes. They're out of the EU whilst mothership Denmark is in. Oh, no. What are you thinking, lass? We're talking about maybe getting our pinky back into Erasmus. Lordy. You know, it's just, where have these guys been? You know, it's extraordinary. It's as wooden as them watching a World Cup again in their suits. It kind of, you know, it's extraordinary because yes. The world has moved on. Everybody has been thinking through lots of detailed stuff. And they, you know, they've come out with these creaking, pathetic offerings, which some commentator said, I think, on Scotland Tonight, and I can't remember which one. But, you know, it is just like the Smith Commission. It's just little incremental stuff that comes along. And I can recall writing of those efforts back in the day that they were always behind the curve. That's what characterizes all of them. By the time they come out, politics has moved on. The unsatisfactory nature of top-down UK has been revealed again. People have moved on. So they are always, if they were a football team moving up the park, they'd be basically punting the ball to where the guy had been 10 minutes ago, you know, which would make for an odd game. That's the game we're in, the stultified, you know, ridiculous backward-facing game we're in with people who just didn't bother their arse actually to even look at what would constitute anything exceptional for Scotland. And also the platitudes that Brown is allowed to get away with on all the interviews where, you know, he's tumbling out with utter rubbish that doesn't even answer the question that anyone's asked. And nobody does what they do with Mick Lynch or anybody else and pull him back to the point saying, you didn't answer the question. What is it with Gordon Brown getting this free pass with half-baked stuff that's just full of dogma, you know, and things that just utterly unsubstantiated claims for his document, which actually is one thing. And then quite evidently, Keir Starmer is just going to just, you know, curry that one into a wee cul-de-sac that he made earlier. Here we go, Gordon, just pop that one in there. And that's going to be the end of it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it was the... They were twice in the opening couple of pages. There was one statement. All the evidence tells us that is what the people of Scotland want and what our recommendations will deliver, which is stronger constitutionally entrenched self-government. And then they go on to say, we know what the people of Scotland, regardless of their view on its constitutional future, want. Cooperation on the issues that affect them. And this is a focus of our recommendations. And it is that whole business of, look, half of you on any opinion poll and the way you actually vote in any form of election tells us you want Scottish independence. We know what we're voting for, but no. We know what you actually want. What you actually want are these mealy-mouthed little tinkering about the edges. And you mentioned the whole thing to do with this new super-duper, we've been promising to abolish the House of Lords, I think, for at least 112 years, and it may not happen in a first term of Labour government. It might be a second term thing. Well, hang on a minute, Paul. You're making a major set of assumptions there, because we know the way politics operates down in England in many areas, where there seems to be this ability to switch from voting Labour to Tory, Tory back to Labour, which I've never understood. I always thought there was a substantial ideological difference that we seem to recognise up here. And it seems to be embedded that you do not vote Conservative if you are someone of a progressive nature or have been able to vote Labour or for a Social Democratic Party in the past. And it's the role of this new Senate, or whatever they're going to call it, in terms of settling disputes. In other countries where they have a constitutional court, which actually resolves disputes between the central government and devolved or federal state, they say that it will be passed up, any issues will be passed up to this new body, but it's not its function to impose a solution on any democratically elected government, but to scrutinise the government and the way in which they sought to resolve the disagreement. So there you have it again. What at the you hit the nail on the head, that sovereignty of Westminster remains. And no matter what bulwarks the Labour Party believe in this document, they're going to be putting in place in order to ensure the continuity of the existence of the Holyrood Parliament, the Welsh Senate, and to ensure that the Sewell Convention will be adhered to, not as a convention, but will be legislated for. Any incoming government can turn around and tear it up, because we have an unwritten, partially written, wholly uncodified constitution that was not tackled. So you're never going to have this firm and settled basis of devolution, or the nearest thing to federal state you can possibly have, without actually engaging in a written constitution. They didn't touch that. They didn't touch the great undemocratic hole at the centre of UK democracy, which is the first-past-the-post voting system, not included in this document either. Nope, there you go. And it was also interesting to read that they did actually recognise within the document that the self-government, devolved government has been undermined, in particular over Brexit and the UK internal market legislation, passed despite the view of Holyrood. Well, there you go, Keir Starmer. We're not going to revisit this. So it may have been undemocratic. It may not have been listened to. But guess what? We're just going to go straight ahead with it. And what comes through continually in the document is this: we will set up a committee. There'll be a council. There'll be consultation. Views will be taken on board. You'll be consulted. Ach, geez, peace. I'm fed up being consulted. I want...
Well,
you're not then.
And the other thing is you're not, you know, because I mean, no. When it comes back to that, which is as weak as that, you know, the being consulted. I mean, I think we've all got the lie to that one now, or not, you know, or you just hit a Liz Truss, you know, who just won't even pick the phone up to first ministers. I mean, it's just, yeah, anything that's a voluntary arrangement in the United Kingdom with the kind of attitudes that were regularly demonstrated by UK prime ministers is a sort of blank check to be walked all over. Yes, the Brexit thing. I mean, there's an interesting thing that Brune was basically saying in his interviews and in his paper, which was that basically independence is the same yearning as Brexit was in England. It was a yearning for some sort of, you know, better kind of government that was closer to, you know, you can fill in the blah. No. I mean, I know you can, after the fact, you can kind of say, I mean, there's something in the sense that two sets of voters looked at a completely broken UK and came to different conclusions. You know, most Scots thinking, think we can probably do the alternative favoured here, was, I think we'll just do this ourselves because this is not never going to be the social democracy we keep voting for. And the folk in England going, let's take back control from Europe because they're the problem. Let's conveniently have scapegoats. And let's vote for extremely right wing people who want to package people like cattle into, you know, aircraft and send them off to an African country. So there's kind of like, you know, that they're making these parallels, trying to create that parallel draws the mind instantly in the same way as, you know, don't think of a pink elephant, boom, in it comes. So, you know, essentially saying we've just got the same reactions. You just look at it and think, see, no. And then the other just weak point on that one is that the cause of independence has been fought for the entire most of last century, long yeah. before Brexit. You know what I mean? It's like that's just kind of just historically completely rubbish. I mean, certainly it's true that everything has been slightly powered up by the evidence of the difference between England and Scotland in voting terms and outlook terms, which has been neatly encapsulated by Brexit. But, you know, Scotland voted for an SNP government in 2007 when, you know, that was not even any, and, you know, there wasn't even a Tory government at that point. So, you know, this is just not the same thing at all. And these lazy conflations, which nobody jumps in and goes, I don't think so, matey, you know, but of course nobody does. And then the other one that I was, really the blood pressure was struggling yesterday. But Brune's other thing where he talks about back in the day, there really was only this kind of sorry choice between independence and the status quo. And now there's this fabby sort of middle ground option for it. Hang on a minute, Gordon. Was it not yourself that was talking about the nearest thing to federalism? I mean, one of the big points that was actually, you know, the vow thing in there at the last minutes was the sort of option B, which hadn't been properly fleshed out, conveniently done at the last minute so nobody was able to ask any of the detail, unlike the white paper for independence, which had mega detail and thus mega criticism. But yeah, you were the one who came in and just flung that sort of plan option B in there, which was just enough of a googly to make people think, oh, look, there's Brune, you know, he's sort of safe pair of hands, Labour. Yeah, you know, they're talking about that's but even though it was utterly improbable, you know, there was a Conservative government at the time. So how was Brune saying something ever going to feed its way through to, you know, David Cameron doing anything? It was like looking at a sort of wiring where you've got wiring at the front of it that you think's connected to a traffic light and you turn round the corner and it's connected to a sort of to an aforementioned electronic pink elephant. Right. So it was obviously nonsense. And yet here he is now, suggesting that, you know, reshaping the reality of the past as being just this, you know, unfortunate choice between extremes. Well, if it was an unfortunate choice between extremes, what was all your promise about? It was obviously nothing unless you've forgotten it. And if it was a choice between two extremes, where was your party? Where were you? Where were all of you, Labour, Lib Dems, all the rest of you, in giving a fleshed out alternative, you know, there? It really beggars belief, actually, the degree to which I think the thing is people nod off. You know, this is a big problem for interviewers. If you just get to the point where you're sort of listening worshipfully, you end up nodding off and waiting to the end of the sentence. And before, you know, when that's happened, 4 hours later, all this rubbish has come out without any challenge at all.
Oh, and when challenged, I believe on Sky, Gordon Brown actually denied. He said we were going to have the nearest thing to federalism you could possibly have. You know, I mean, it's up there. However, Professor James Mitchell in the Holyrood magazine reckons Brown's pulled it off. He says that the constitutional initiative is now passed to Labour. Its critique of the UK is now more critical than that of the SNP. And they offer a coherent programme of reform, given the fact, wait for this, the SNP has entered a period of decline and internal division. It's another straight past you. I mean, it's a 50-yard Harry Souter for Australia, you know, in the World Cup. Reports of the SNP's demise.
Yeah, I mean, this was a column I wrote for the Herald on Monday. And of course, everybody is cheerfully, well, everyone that, you know, from a unionist persuasion, and I'm not putting James Mitchell in there, actually, but many of the papers are cheerfully predicting that this is the end of the SNP. They've reached the cul-de-sac, Nicola Wilbiowski, you know, and we're not getting into the full kind of politics behind all of that, but just this sort of connection between the Supreme Court ruling and a sort of real problem for the SNP. And actually, you know, it seems to me that it could just as easily be exactly the opposite. I mean, everybody predicted this when the independence referendum was lost and Alex stood down. What happened was that the SNP support was went bonkers, that the applications for membership rose. I'm not saying that's all happened at the moment, but just that, you know, two and two does not equal four in this analysis at all, because every time Westminster flexes its muscles and people begin to realise this is a real serious game on moment, it tends to actually get folk, if you like, re-energised. And that's all I'm noticing around the place in terms of kind of yes groups and so on, that everybody has basically perked up and thought, right, game on again, even if they can't quite see the mechanism. But even more than that, if you just take a kind of flutter through a lot of the Westminster press around this time, it's interesting how many people are coming in with detailed criticisms of what might happen in the next independence referendum, which rather suggests they think it will happen, see. So the Times columnist Alexander Walker was arguing that the big problem last time round was blocking expats from voting. There's a wee thing here. First of all, you know, both governments did agree to, you know, the franchise. But anyway, he was saying it bucked the international trend and it wrongly deflated the no vote. If Scots living abroad could vote, he thinks, they would all now vote no. And he thinks this loophole should be closed before the next independence referendum, which kind of indirectly confirms the idea that they're so worried that there is going to be a next referendum that people are starting to get their, you know, criticisms in early, basically. I mean, you'd have to say, if you really want to start getting into voting eligibility, knock yourself out, lad, you know, because the Scottish run Indy Ref, the differences between the two are really, we've said this before, but very interesting, because the Scottish run independence referendum it let anyone vote who was registered at an address in Scotland. So that wasn't ethnic. That was just, you were here, that's fine, on you go. The Westminster run one with Brexit was confined to British, Irish, Commonwealth citizens. So essentially where you were born. It meant that EU citizens couldn't vote in the Brexit one, could vote in the Scottish independence one. And that's the outlook that the Scottish, nobody argued particularly about that here. I mean, you know, it's marginal arguments, but most people were very happy with the idea that it's where you live, viz. Scotland, versus where you were born, viz. The UK way of working. And people were very happy with that here. And in fact, it was commented upon across Europe that this was a really good, exceptionally civic way to approach something so that it didn't rely upon ethnicity. So if you want to open up this whole thing again, you know, to sort of say this ethnicity issue, so wherever you've gone and lived in life, and perhaps if you haven't even been here for the last 50 years, a.k.a., you know, Sean Connery back at the 2014 moment, no yesers were banging up around about Sean Connery being given the right to vote in the Bahamas. I mean, the way that the franchise was established very much reflected the kind of attitude that Scots have. So I'm sorry, matey, unless you just want to kind of do another of these bringing in and trying to kind of fiddle the vote. He's also very unhappy about the idea of 16 and 17 year olds being included in a Scottish referendum. And you sort of think, see, if any of you would ever come out with an attractive future vision of Brexited Britain, it just might be more appealing to 16 and 17 year olds who'll end up voting anyway than actually trying to exclude them, which they'll notice. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, but I mean, there are other voices, because I mean, you highlighted the fact that Polly Toynbee, and I saw a bit of the interview where she the discussion that she was having, where she suggested that Keir Starmer should call the SNP's bluff, again framed as the SNP, call the SNP's bluff, and the minute a new Labour government came into power, he should agree a second independence referendum. And she did it. Let them have their referendum. I find that an interesting reference. I mean, to them ones, but she's come up with that one. Do you think that one will fly?
Well, it's more, I mean, that's what I was going to go on to say. That's what most of the article is actually about. But it certainly is more impactful, probably, given that Labour's consistent poll lead. So we're probably dealing with a Labour government now rather than, you know, the dying embers of Tory thinking, as it were. But it's another kind of extraordinary one. Her thinking, and it was backed up in that conversation by Paul Waugh, who's the chief political commentator at the Eye paper. And you'd have to be fair to Polly and say that she did sort of say, you know, it breaks her heart to say this, but she can see that the Scots are essentially offsky, you know, or that is kind of a frame of thinking. And she had a lot of sympathy. She wasn't just being a hard line, you know, you guys are just going to get towed back in because it sort of gives us a problem as lefties here. But there's all sorts of problems with this. The main one, I suppose, is that there's this presumption in the thinking that that independence is somehow sloppy seconds.
Yeah.
You know, for anybody who was an actual Labour voter, you're still deep down there. You could be reactivated quite easily. I've got to say, having listened to Mick Lynch this morning on Radio 5 live, if Mick Lynch was leading the Labour Party, I think there'd be a lot more people who would sort of give that idea airtime. But really, you know, Keir Starmer's led Labour Party, I just don't think that's going to be it. I can see that English lefties are getting excited about the prospect of a Labour Prime Minister, and they automatically assume Scottish lefties will feel the same. But this is to completely ignore the different calibration of political register and what's happened since, you know, in the last 20 years. And that just goes back to the point made earlier. When Labour collapsed here in 2007, it did so, you know, south of the border, everybody was still toeing the line and voting Labour. So things seemed to happen earlier here. And the bulk of those folk shifted straight over to another social democratic party, the SNP, whilst when, you know, the substance hit the fan south of the border for Labour, the bulk of people seem to have, as you said earlier, bafflingly moved to a right of centre set of options presented by, you know, Nigel Farage's Brexit Party, now the Reform Party, you know, the sort of successor is poking its head over the parapet. And that thus enabling the most right-wing conservative government for, you know, generations, probably outdoing even George Osborne et al. So that's just not the same. You know, what's happening in Scotland is a sort of slow realisation that we are a social democracy in a conservative country. And actually, once the penny's dropped, you really aren't going to resile from that other than to just be broken. And, you know, I don't think anybody here is ready to give up on an idea. And again, some of the language, I see it softening now a little bit, but give them, you know, 5 minutes, they'll be back on it again. When they talk about the SNP, and remember, they should remember that, you know, there's probably half of Scots have voted SNP. So, you know, whether they support independence or not, they voted SNP. So when they talk about the SNP as if it's some form of scabious vermin, or, you know, a kind of leprosy related disease, they should really watch what they're doing, because just as Starmer avoids insulting Brexiteers because he needs to coax them back over, all the stuff that's been said about the impossibility of working with those people, you know, the SNP, then fill in the characterizations you want, is basically tarring all those supporters with the same brush. And I don't know how you think that people who are being essentially treated by extension as part of some scabious conspiracy towards denying a decent left-wing government in Britain, that, you know, is what comes with every other description of the SNP from Keir Starmer. How is that going to woo over people who basically just want the possibility of socialism in their lifetimes, as opposed to endless struggle in a conservative United Kingdom? That's the decision people have made. And I wish people could just for once accept, Labour could accept that that's the calculation most people made, and we're not idiots.
Yeah. And there is always the assumption made that the Labour Party is somehow socialist. You know, I mean, it's the...
Well, to be fair, it's the same assumption as making the SNP is socialist.
Exactly.
Which is where I carefully said the possibility of socialism in your
absolutely.
Lifetime.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, many of us vote SNP, are in favour of Scottish independence. And the first thing, as I said, I've said it several times, that I was asked in a survey, what's the first thing you would get rid of in an independent Scotland? I said an SNP government. I want to see a genuine, cooperative, community-based, left of centre Green Party in power, and I will work towards that. And it's an interesting one. You mentioned Mick Lynch earlier. His great hero is James Connolly, another one, man who was excoriated by Labourism and Labourists when he suggested the fact that it could be an independent Ireland and that Ireland could be socialist, and we set up the Irish Transport and General Workers Union. He was again criticised roundly by the Labour movement in the United Kingdom because he was breaking up the United Kingdom. So it is a line that is continually taken. And I reckon if Mick Lynch were leader of the Labour Party, he would be nodding assent to a second independence referendum, because as he has said before, it's up to the people of Scotland to decide. But again, it is that focus. We're all coming round to 2024, aren't we, Leslie? That seems to be where everyone's heading, because because one of the polls is suggesting the two most recent, there could be a hung parliament with a minority Labour government, obviously dependent upon other left of centre parties, Plaid Cymru, the Greens, the SNP, in order to get through any legislation. And the other one suggesting there could be, and the more recent one suggesting there could be an absolute landslide Labour victory. Does place the SNP's position in 2024, using it as a de facto referendum, makes it interesting. I often wonder, you know, could the SNP go down and be absolutely explicit? Would we about being abstentionist in 2024? See, we're going to have an independence, de facto independence referendum. And if we do not get that independence referendum based upon what's happened, we will not go into Westminster. Is that too big a risk to take? Do you think they will actually take it?
No, they won't do that in a month of Sundays as long as Nicola Sturgeon's leader. I mean, that's not the way. They just don't do bold things, you know. And in fact, that was, you know, another point in all of this with Keir Starmer. Would that he was the kind of leader that might think, here's a bit of a wheeze. Why don't we, you know, as soon as Labour's in and, you know, we're the kind of people that look a bit more benign to a Scottish electorate, why don't we then have, which was the point, the Polly Toynbee suggestion, why don't we then have an independence referendum to put it to bed forever under a benign Labour government, not a nasty Tory government? Now, if he was the kind of politician that might give that serious air time, we wouldn't be where we are now. But he's not, you know, just exactly as he's not strong enough to even, you know, look again at Brexit when half the population, which means the majority in England even, are now having buyer's regret on Brexit. But as far as 2024 is concerned, I mean, it's difficult because, I mean, now that the genie's, you know, now that there's been a strategy announced, it's kind of difficult to unannounce it. It's also going to happen as an election. So, and it will happen within a political time frame when the nature of elections has now changed, because the idea of a de facto referendum has been arrived at, because Section 30 was finally requested from Boris Johnson and refused in the final days of his political life, because the Supreme Court manoeuvre means that we know that there isn't a lawful option to the referendum bill, an awful lot of things have fallen into place just in the last kind of 4 months, which mean that it's hard to see how the SNP could conduct another any other election campaign as if it's just, you know, we've got a wee space on the end of the mantelpiece for another mandate. Should we just squeeze that one in there? If we move them along a wee bit, you know, we could fit the 17th one in. Now, that's not to say that, I mean, it is quite extraordinary how much, nonetheless, it is possible for the SNP to sort of backtrack. But I think there's too much out there. And that's now true for yes voters. There's got to be some strategy for 2024. You can't just go in and sort of say, oh, we actually sort of changed our mind and we're going to have a full manifesto on everything. And actually, it will be about everything. But look, we're going to put this in 24 point about independence. The rest of it's in 18 points. So knock yourselves out. You can see what our, you know, our real priorities are. I don't think you can do that now. So it is, I've heard all sorts of theories in the background with people thinking you can try with a majority in the general election, looking for that majority as a de facto proxy vote, and then move on to use the Holyrood election as the real kind of killer blow type one if you don't get very far. But then, as was rightly pointed out last night, in Scotland Tonight by Jeff Aberdeen, you know, the danger is getting 49.9% of the vote in a general election, which is actually compatible with winning totally the lion's share of actual votes since it's first past the post. And you could appear then to have actually put the tin lid on independence for a generation. And I don't know how that one gets worked through. I mean, when I was in Iceland, and God, it was the talk of the steamy there. I was just saying to another friend recently how extraordinary it is that when you do go abroad, you find people totally up to speed on many of the characters in the whole of, you know, British politics. And it's not just the folk who are complete anoraks. But one person there said this is fiendishly cunning on the part of Nicola Sturgeon, because it is basically shit or bust. You know, it does make everybody think we're now at Beecher's Brook. There's no other fences involved. We're at that very last big, you know, almost impossible to jump fence. And, you know, everybody has to knuckle down, get into line and really organize on this one, because otherwise we will potentially screw this up for quite a long time. I'm not a great subscriber to the strategy theory when it comes to Nicola Sturgeon. She's a tremendous communicator, but she's just not proven herself to be a tremendous strategist. So I suspect this is just the product of something that happened one day when something had to be said. And but nonetheless, that dems the brakes. You know, that's the way that politics develops, through sentences said, you know, just like the once in a generation said, you know, twice or something by Alex Salmond. If it hadn't been him, if he hadn't said it, then they'd have found another way. You know, I'm not criticizing anybody.
No.
You know, because it's ludicrous that you should be banged to rights for something you say once, when it's the sovereignty of the people that matters, never mind what any politician says. But anyway, I suspect that there'll have to be some sort of different approach to 2024. But I also suspect that the SNP will be sitting, as we speak, leadership, trying to figure out a way for that not to be a single manifesto saying independence with a rider on the bottom. And if we don't get it, we're going to take our guys back out of Westminster. I just don't think that's the way they work.
No. Well, I mean, what we've actually, I mean, you talked about leadership, what we've got coming up this evening, we'll find out who'll take over from Ian Blackford as leader at Westminster. Will it be Stephen Flynn? And I believe that she's been referred to as the firebrand, Mary Black being deputy leader, and Alison Thewlis with Stuart MacDonald as the candidate for deputy leader there. You know, it is kind of the thing. See, I have no problem with the SNP forever just putting forward a one-line manifesto, which is, we believe in Scottish independence, that's what you're voting for. Because fundamentally, unless there is actually a minority Labour government in power, that's all they can do. They can put things in manifestos and they'll be utterly irrelevant because they will never be taken intent of. And, you know, I reflect on the fact that replacing Ian Blackford, what is the most memorable thing about Ian Blackford as leader of the Westminster group for the SNP? Was the day he led in 2018, I think it was, because there was a refusal to allow appropriate time to debate the impact of Brexit on devolution and the devolved governments in Scotland and Wales. He led the SNP out of the chamber. And at that point, I stood up and cheered. I thought, that's actually being genuinely disruptive, you know. And I'm trying to identify the massive differences between Stephen Flynn and Alison Thewlis. It will be represented as he's less subservient. He won't toe the Edinburgh line quite as much. And Alison Thewlis is the continuity candidate. The one thing I'm absolutely certain about the two of them, I believe, is that they've both done Unite supporters, and that's about it. But will it make any difference, you know, other than the fact that they get to ask these two questions at that ritualistic pantomime of PMQs?
Well, it won't make a massive difference, really, because, again, as was pointed out last night, on Scotland Tonight, sorry, I'm not here plugging them. It's just, you know, it's a journalistic habit of attributing kind of detail. It's the other way, in the same sense as the Tories Scottish secretary is seen as kind of, you know, the Westminster government's man in Scotland. Essentially, it's completely the other way around. So that Edinburgh's where it's at for the SNP. So the Westminster end is very much the sort of, you know, the sort of dud end of the equation, if you like, in power terms. And obviously, Nicola Sturgeon, being a very kind of careful woman who keeps all the control of everything to herself, literally, is not really want to have anybody who's going to start tangoing and waltzing around the place and, you know, behaving in ways that she doesn't want to have happen in Westminster. And that's where this divide probably sits. And nonetheless, it also sits not with the majority of voters or anything, but literally with those MPs. So whilst we could have a conversation here as to what would float our boat, it's kind of irrelevant in the sense that it's those MPs who need to decide. Now, quite a number of them have felt very frustrated because quite a number of them came in only because of the independence referendum. Yeah. You know, they've got day jobs they could be doing and had not envisaged spending the rest of their lives being Westminster MPs, albeit some of them are nestling in, you know, you've got to get to a stage where it works for you or you couldn't possibly bear it. But, you know, so... those folk are going to want to ruck it up a bit, I would have thought, and would, I know, have been frustrated behind the scenes about the kind of just keep it all going, look like you're in a, you know, a sort of respectable opposition, keep playing the game, pat the thing back over the net, you know, look outraged when you have to look outraged. And to be fair to Ian Blackford, a lot of the time he was the only one who actually raised the obvious political question of the day when a variety of Corbyn, you know, Starmer and everybody was off on something really quite tangential. So that's what she'll presumably, she's the same woman, Nicola, so she'll keep wanting the same thing as she's always wanted, which is to just keep banging the ball over the net in a sort of, you know, mannerly way that suggests you're still playing tennis. A lot of us have got fed up with that. I think a lot of people, a lot of MPs are worried about the use of a general election as a de facto referendum, because it, after all, affects them and their careers and futures more than it affects anybody else. It may feel to them that they're slightly being sort of dangled over the edge, you know, as the kind of experimental, you know, the sort of, yeah, the experiment of the piece. Which way that would lean you in terms of candidates, I'm not too sure. There's, of course, been this idea that there was a bit of a kind of things went off a bit weirdly in that it was a fairly open secret, certainly around SNP conference, that Stephen Flynn was quietly amassing support. Somehow that got leaked a bit early, and that made him then have to come out and say, no, he wasn't standing, which kind of was a bit of a guddle. And it also was a guddle in terms of it, you know, one minute Ian Blackford's going to go on forever, the next minute, you know, he concedes it probably needs fresh blood. So that was all not ideal, really, in terms of handling. But I understand as well, some of his guys have been sort of briefing that there would be a complete clear out of all the posts held at the Westminster side, which is sort of, in a way, is kind of what you know, you might expect a bit of a change. And you see as well that Kirsten Oswald stood down almost immediately as deputy, seeing that if there was going to be a new, you know, Westminster leader, you'd probably want to have freedom of manoeuvre to, you know, get a whole team in there, which then allowed both those candidates, Alison Thewlis and Stephen Flynn, to then announce their sort of deputies. Well, I mean, it sort of stands to reason that you'd probably want to change a bit more than just deputies. So in a way, that's no big surprise. But I guess it destabilizes, obviously, all those people who hold the positions they hold at the moment on that front bench, because it rather suggests they're going to get their jotters. So I don't know where things are. And if you look at, you know, on all of it, they're both very capable speakers.
Absolutely.
You know, so and they're both going to feel new and in their different ways, quite sort of representing a younger demographic of politician, actually, and never mind independent supporter. They look like they look new. That they don't look like the old brigade. It looks like, my God, there's a whole other freaking generation of them coming over the top now. I mean, that's not a bad thing, whichever one of them gets the job. There are just wee things. The National did a very useful compare and contrast. Some things are kind of surprising in that, well, maybe not so surprising given Stephen Flynn's Aberdeenshire location, but he's there was apparently a thing in the Telegraph at the weekend saying he would challenge Nicola Sturgeon's crazy opposition to drilling for new oil and gas fields. Alison Thewlis is much more on board with the, nope, it all has to stay on the ground. So you can look through, you know, the different kind of emphases they have, but it certainly does look as if there's going to be a bit more of a kind of, yeah, a bit more of rucking about with Stephen Flynn than with Alison Thewlis. But really, whichever one of them comes to the fore, they'll make an impact every time they stand up simply because of their relative youth and their articulacy and the fact that it is not just an old brigade that you can hope just dies off and kind of disappears and that somehow business will return to normal. Every time they stand up, they'll be younger than everybody else around them, you know, and I think that's massively impactful.
Yep. Meanwhile, back in the real world, you're suggesting that the Yes movement, because post the rallies, that's been the a major part of your focus, which is actually to think how the Yes movement can move forward separate from but and working in concert with the political parties, people of all parties, people of no party. And you suggested that the egg, your spiritual home, can be an inspiration for the Yes movement.
Yes. Well, it was, and you know, afterwards I thought, I don't know, was that a right sort of column to write? Sometimes you write them, you think, I don't know about that. Actually,
yeah.
You know,
so, oh yeah.
It's too late now. It's gone. But it was more just the business of what, you know, after something, people don't remember all the difficulties. They just remember the outcome. So people will remember, hopefully, that egg was bought by the community in 1997. But along the way, there were so many difficulties that really stressed people and tested resolve in much the same way as all the sort of false dawns, in much the same way as, in a way, the Yes movement stands now. And the thing that was really key, when there was a massive knockback, and there were a couple of really major disappointments. I mean, one was, I remember when the National Heritage Memorial Fund was going to give the islanders £1 million to basically buy the island. They'd still have had to find a bit themselves, but actually did it with strings attached so that the islanders would only ever have 49% control of the island. The rest of it would be, you know, the 51% would basically be suits of one sort or another. And the representative of the islander in that conversation in London just got up, thanked them for their time, turned on his heel and walked out.
Yeah.
Now, that was pretty impressive, you know, because they had basically heard what I remember Alan McRae saying, because I was in the room at the time, Alan McRae from the Ascent Crofters, who came over to Egg and memorably said to everyone, no half measures, no, don't go for gold. He said, don't be bought off. Don't let them say, oh, we'll give you these rights and not those rights. Get the whole rights over your land. Nothing short of it. Nothing short of it. And I mean, if anyone had ever heard Alan speak, you can believe that you know, whether it was on a podium in Sutherland or, you know, sitting in a kitchen and egg, was a powerful message which really worked its way through with people. So they were solid on that. They were not going to cave in to anything like, you know, Gordon Brown's, you know, revised sort of ideas of not federalism, which just by the by is not on the table again, I notice.
Yeah.
So anyway, they stuck with it. And the other thing was they really strengthened their own internal solidarity as a group of people. So, you know, when they had meetings, and obviously not everybody comes to a meeting, especially people who are a bit grumpy and don't agree with the buyout idea, They took it upon themselves to divvy the island up into essentially parishes. Not that this was terribly modelled on church going, since they are such a godless bunch. But nonetheless, the kind of parish elder idea, not a bad one, because after meetings, they would come back home, put the jacket back on again, go straight out the door and go and talk to people who had, you know, hadn't been at the meeting, so that at least they couldn't say they hadn't been kept in the loop. And it always really impressed me when I watched how this was not done from some manual of how you keep people on a long journey, you know, united. It was just an obvious thing to do that just emerged, like so many of the things that just emerged on Egg, which were pretty impressive, because that's what people do, left to their own devices without templates of, you know, all the kind of professionalized stuff that gets placed on top of them. So the point I was trying to make simply was that we need to do the same thing and make sure that our internal cohesion is basically much greater than it has been. And that does mean, I mean, that's why when it came to that rally in Edinburgh, I was at pains to actually make sure there was an ALBA speaker on the platform. And it was great that actually that didn't mean that Nicola Sturgeon called off. It didn't stop Tommy Shepherd speaking. In fact, Tommy made a very strong point in the rally about the need, exactly the same point about the need for all parts of the movement and different parties to come together. Equally, Neil Hanvey didn't use the occasion to make any snippy points about the SNP and spoke very powerfully. This will all be coming in little clips because we decided to make an advent calendar of stuff, which is easy for us to say, but poor Stuart Kerr Brown, who's doing all of this, who's brilliant, is him that has to do. You'll appreciate this, Pat, because we can decide whatever we want to do here, but it's you that has to do the donkey work behind the scenes on all of it, you know. But anyway, so the advent calendars are going out and you'll see the clips of Tommy and Neil and all the rest of them. It did, however, mean that the Greens didn't appear, which nobody seems to have noticed. I would have thought that should be a warning or problematic sign for somebody, because they have a position of not appearing on any platform where ALBA is present, which wasn't explained to me at the time. It was explained to me by a councillor when I was mystified about not having any calls returned from people that I had actually stood and done stuff with in the Greens. So, I mean, you know, you'd like to just this. I can appreciate people have got to positions and sort of locked themselves in a bit here. But the rest of us, as we move forward, and this applies to all sorts of gigs that are going on. I see that there's one going on in Aberdeen, which will again, I think, unfortunately, end up being a game of two separate halves. It would just be so great if people could find a way to just knit in the opposite party that you don't think is your guys currently. Mm-hmm. Because it's one of these things that, you know, when we become independent, we're all going to have to try to work with people who with whom we have even greater objections. Vince, yes. Everybody that voted no. So how does it look? And I know that there's a lot of, you know, you can be a bit Pollyanna-ish about working together. I mean, that, after all, is the unionist shtick, which kind of overlooks completely the sort of real differences of opinion that lie beneath. But simply just if there is a way to try to do some moments of common cause, it just would, you know, create dividends. And the Yes movement should be the one that does that, because we can call the shots. Yeah. When it was personally speaking, when it was the Holyrood rally, that principally speaking, I and four other guys who didn't want to be front of house was organising, then I can decide who we invite. If it's parties that organise stuff, they're always going to be a bit nippy. So come on, Yes movement, you're the only way that if you step forward, you can decide who to invite. And then, of course, that does leave it up to some, you know, people to just decide the presence of one person means the absence of them. But you get to try and please try.
Yeah. I mean, because the Yes movement can go where politicians fear to tread. And it is about inclusion and it is about working together. And we've got more that unites us than separates us, and in my perspective there. I mean, but that's again, I'm sounding very kumbaya there, aren't I? Which is not like me at all. But I've got a smile on my face, Leslie, genuinely. And it may seem rather odd, because I'm going to make a recommendation that I think a movie I think that you'll love, because it's centered on the investigation carried out by the New York Times into the abuse of women, sexual abuse of women in Hollywood, and focused on Harvey Weinstein, who is currently in jail and is now under investigation for, I think, 80-odd other charges, you know, which could see him spending the rest of his life in jail. And it's an absolutely remarkable production. I mean, you'll have to work hard to find it. It, for some odd reason, when the way it was distributed, it hasn't been able to build up the following, the movie, she said, that it really ought to have done, because it's an absolutely marvellous piece of work. It kind of takes the line that All the President's Men did, you know, with two intrepid reporters, with the support of their strong-hearted editor, investigating on midnight stakeouts, you know, doing the legwork, having meetings on and off the record. But the big difference about this is, she said, is directed by a woman, written by a woman, cinematography by a woman. And the three main characters, Jodie Cantor, Megan Toomey and Rebecca Corbett, who are the two investigative reporters and the editor at the New York Times. It's focused on these women. And unlike Woodward and Bernstein, who seem to exist in that world where only newspapers existed, these are women with hinterlands. You know, the two reporters, Cantor and Toomey, both mothers, you know, who literally leave supportive husbands holding the babies. And there are two tremendous cameos from Samantha Morton and Jennifer L. And even more powerfully, what they've actually done is they've included documentary audio footage and video footage in the movie. And Gwyneth Paltrow and Ashley Judd appear as themselves in the film. It is a remarkable piece of work in terms of journalism. And it's terrific. If you're interested in investigative reporting, if you're interested in this story, which actually begins with their tackling Donald Trump and his statements about sexual exploitation, which he dismissed as locker room talk, that kicks the whole thing off. And they make a very explicit connection between Trump and what he did, and that whole power nexus of the patriarchy and the way that Harvey Weinstein operated in Hollywood. It's a tremendous piece. And if you're interested in journalism, it's a great one to go and see. I can't recommend it highly enough, and I hope that more people go and see it. It's terrific.
Right, duly noted. I will be off to see that one. I was actually off at my best friend's mother's funeral at the weekend, and she decided when we came back from that we were just going to watch something that was just completely not challenging at yes. all, just, you know, fluffy. And it was absolutely dreadful, actually. It was George Clooney and Julia Roberts and whatever. Oh. I can't even remember the name of the film, actually.
Ticket to Paradise.
Yeah.
Ooh, I've seen it.
Have you? Wasn't it just...
No, I liked it. It was a romantic comedy that I just thought was a hoot, and I switched my brain off and thoroughly enjoyed it.
You were with the majority in the room. I was just sitting, obviously being kind of, you know, I think actually the thing is, I have to accept that I need to wear glasses now to see. I was sort of possibly missing quite a lot of the action. But the other thing in that vein, when I came back, I noticed that there's a film on Netflix, Troll, which is the most watched thing. Now, that is another lovely little canter around a piece of nonsense in a sense, but it dips into this strange belief that all the Nordics have, that there are hidden people in stone. Mm. And the Icelanders certainly have it. You know, if you're in Iceland, you can see bits where the carriageways have divided to leave a big stone untouched in the middle of motorways even. Yeah. But obviously the Norwegians have had a very kind of, you know, laid out set of thoughts about trolls. And it seems a bit silly, you know, in a way. What's mentioned in the film, and what kind of really perked my ears up, though, was reference to a fabulous Norwegian painter, artist, Kittelsen, who drew lots of pictures of trolls. And the thing is that what he portrays is sort of mountains that, when you look carefully at them, have a beautifully painted tiny feet, or... You know, he's basically making all things that we regard as inanimate, animate. Mm. And it pulls a connection between the Earth, the planet, and animal kind and humankind, essentially, so that there's not, you know, there's things can come out of stone, so that it's not just an irrelevance to us. It's not just, yeah, a lump of stone. It's, and in a funny kind of way, that's probably a big part of the national psyche. If you go to the art galleries I often do in Oslo, Kittelsen's work is up there front of house. And, you know, it makes me sort of marvel, really, at a country that doesn't dismiss something like that as just the work of, you know, that's just for children. Mm-hmm. The idea of, you know, this is just a makey-uppy thing. And in fact, I've got a little Kittelsen sitting over my bed as a sort of lovely, it seems to me to be a lovely thing that just connects all our worlds together so well, so effortlessly, so beautifully. And then in the middle of this movie, it becomes part of the kind of part of the story, part of the plot. So aye, Kittelsen, nice thing to just have a little Google at and marvel really at our worlds and the beauty and wonder of them all.
Well, that, I can't think of a better way to finish this week's podcast than that. And we'll see you next week, Chomsky.